Hello, and welcome to the Story of Singapore, Episode 13, The Winner Takes It All. Nearly 2.5 years had passed since Farquhar was officially replaced by Crawford. Many things had changed since then, and the British had big plans for the colony. Singapore was about to enter the next phase of its colonial history, but hold your horses. We will return to Crawford and his administration of Singapore in the next episode. For now, we have a score to settle. The committee presiding over Farquhar's petition against Raffles took 6 months to comb through the claims and counterclaims of both men. On the 26th of October, 1825, the committee's report was finalized and read to the Court of Directors. These were their conclusions. Regarding the dispute over construction on the North Bank, the committee found that Farquhar did not have the legal right to deviate from protocols set by Raffles. They accepted Raffles' claim that East Beach was not as unfit for commercial purposes as Farquhar had claimed. They rejected Farquhar's claim that the merchants established their quarters on the North Bank with the express knowledge that this arrangement was conditional or temporary. The certificates of occupancy that Farquhar had issued when he granted land did not mention the possibility of land resumption by the government without compensation. That risk was not made transparent to the merchants. The consensus was that Farquhar was administering to the best of his judgment, but he had disobeyed orders and was rightfully reprimanded by the Bengal government. Regarding the unfair distribution of land allotments, the committee found that Farquhar was not guilty of practicing favoritism. However, they questioned the assignment of land to individuals by order of application, even though Raffles had instructed as such. The first-come, first-served approach might not have been the most equitable one. Late arrivals to the settlement would have been disadvantaged because the best plots of land had already been taken up. The system's design also failed to factor in the potential contributions of these settlers, some of whom might have brought higher productivity to Singapore's economy than its pioneers. Not to mention, many of these pioneers settled in Singapore on the basis of trust and their association with Farquhar, which was crucial to the colony's development but also made the situation all the grayer. Regarding the excessive expenses incurred during Farquhar's administration, the committee found that Farquhar was not guilty of profligate spending. They acknowledged that Farquhar was not fiscally irresponsible and that the infrastructure projects he had undertaken were not unnecessary extravagances. However, they condemned Farquhar's 8% commission as supervising engineer, even though Raffles had approved it. They considered it a major conflict of interest. Regarding the promotion of social ills in the settlement, the committee found that Farquhar was not guilty of endorsing the slave trade nor gambling activities. They accepted Farquhar's view that compared to outright prohibition, regulatory licenses were a more practical solution to curbing surging crime rates in Singapore. Both slavery and gambling had already been institutionalized in Malay and Chinese cultures respectively prior to colonial Singapore. Furthermore, the small size of the police force would have made enforcement nigh impossible and would have given rise to organized crime societies as well as corruption within the bureaucracy. However, they remarked that it was weird for Farquhar to operate under the assumption that Singapore was an Asian port instead of a British one. Regarding Farquhar's removal from office, the committee found that the Bengal government's decision to replace him as resident of Singapore was reasonable and justified. They concluded that while Farquhar was neither negligent nor dishonest, he had displayed signs of poor judgment, especially when he had disobeyed explicit orders to reserve the North Bank for government purposes, an act that was detrimental to public interest and enough to warrant his replacement. Additionally, they accepted Raffles' claim that Farquhar had requested to be relieved of his duties time after time. Farquhar later withdrawing his application to take leave did not change the fact that he had originally wished to do so. Moreover, if the Bengal government had deemed Farquhar to be unfit to administer the settlement without Raffles watching over him, then no other reason was really needed. As for Raffles preemptively dismissing Farquhar as both resident and commandant without authorization, that was where the waters were muddied. The committee found that Raffles removing Farquhar from the chain of command of the troops was totally uncalled for. They rejected Raffles' claim that Farquhar was planning to stage a coup and accepted the Bengal government's view that Raffles had acted in a manner too extreme. However, the committee was uncertain about the extent of Raffles' jurisdiction in Singapore. But since Raffles had such a strong conviction against Farquhar, they thought perhaps some allowance was in order. In summary, though the committee's report cleared Farquhar of the most egregious allegations and scandals, it was not a good look on him. The image painted of him was that of a bumbling clown. Compared to the usual affairs, Farquhar's petition was one of the longer and more complicated motions put before the court of directors. Indeed, the case was an ambiguous one, and they deliberated over the committee's findings for a week, and then deferred their decision again for another week. On the 9th of November, 1825, after much thought and consideration, the court of directors reached a final decision. The committee's report was approved and Farquhar would not be reinstated as the resident of Singapore. Farquhar was devastated by the verdict. I doubt he had been expecting such an outcome when he brought his grievances to the attention of the court of directors. On the flip side, Raffles was probably grinning from year to year, glad to have finally gotten Farquhar off his back. That is, until the court of directors turned their gaze on him. They demanded explanations from Raffles for his ill-treatment of Farquhar along with several other charges of misconduct. His whole history of inflated allowances, bloated salaries, and other financial discrepancies had finally caught up with him. No, Raffles did not pass the audit. In the end, he was not granted his pension. Instead, the company presented him with a bill for £22,000. Adjusting for inflation based on numbers by the Bank of England, that amounts to roughly £1.7 million today. So, why did Farquhar lose his case, despite the evidence against Raffles? We can postulate a few reasons. Firstly, the court of directors and the committee assessing Farquhar's petition consisted of men who were not based in anywhere close to Southeast Asia. These were politicians and aristocrats with very little personal experience with Asia, and thus had limited understanding of local and regional politics. If there was already a noticeable gap in understanding between Farquhar and the Bengal government, then the gap could only get a lot wider and foggier the further we move from Singapore. Just because the court of directors had the relevant documents, reports, and correspondences did not mean that they were clairvoyant about Farquhar's ordeal. They relied on the Bengal government to orientate their own decision-making processes and consequently echoed much of the same sentiments and resolutions. Secondly, Farquhar was not just challenging the actions and decisions of Raffles and the Bengal government. He was also, in effect, challenging the authority and hierarchy of the entire company. Restoring Farquhar to office would be tantamount to admitting that the Bengal government had made a mistake, and a significant one at that, by condemning Farquhar without even investigating the allegations. Furthermore, Raffles was a senior official who had been given a position of power and was widely connected with powerful people. Taking him down for abuses of power would blemish the company's reputation. These issues signified major lapses in the company's processes. Its political opponents would have a few-day opening lines of inquiry into its operations, communication, and transparency. To do Farquhar justice was to take the company down a notch. Thirdly, the Singapore at this juncture was not the Singapore that Farquhar knew. The geopolitical realities of Southeast Asia had changed dramatically since Farquhar left the settlement 2 years ago. Singapore was no longer that underfunded, undermanned, and underprotected colony, disowned by British leaders and in peril of Dutch invasion. Now, it was the shining jewel of British colonialism in the Far East, recognized for its excellent growth, trading potential, and strategic importance to the empire. The experience and achievements that Farquhar had cited to justify his reinstatement were already behind the times. Singapore was not the same anymore, and Farquhar was not there to manage its transition. The impact of the Court of Directors' ruling on the memory of Singapore's two founding fathers cannot be understated. The denizens of Singapore in 1823 remembered Farquhar fondly and Raffles poorly. But how do the citizens of Singapore today remember the two of them? If you look around the city, it is easy to find traces of Raffles' legacy in various landmarks. Stamford Road, Raffles City, Raffles Place, Raffles Hotel, Raffles Boulevard, Raffles Hospital, Raffles Institution. There is also a statue of Raffles along the Singapore River and another statue of him in front of the Victoria Theatre and Concert Hall. As for Farquhar, he has all but vanished from its maps. Around 380 streets in Singapore are named after Britons, but none today bears his name. In her book, William Farquhar and Singapore, Nadia Wright says this, quote, "When the achievements of great individuals are exaggerated, an enormous shadow is cast over the work of their subordinates." End quote. As perplexing as it may seem, popular memory has placed Raffles on a pedestal and Farquhar on the sidelines. Raffles was the man who selected Singapore as the site of the new British trading settlement in Southeast Asia, the man who acquired it for the empire, and the man who transformed it from an obscure fishing village into a great seaport and modern metropolis. On the other hand, Farquhar is often either overlooked or viewed upon as the incompetent, disobedient, and corrupt subordinate who allowed social ills into the colony and thus deserved to be fired. These perspectives are far from the truth, but they have been entrenched for such a long time. Early biographers saw in Raffles a character worthy of admiration and sympathy. There were certain elements in his life that fit the classic story archetypes of rags to riches and tragedy. Parroting Raffles' self-praises in his letters to his wife and friends, they romanticized his accomplishments, glossed over his flaws, and denigrated Farquhar's contributions. Raffles was mythologized as the sole founder of the highly successful Singapore. At the same time, subsequent colonial governments of Singapore memorialized Raffles by commissioning statues in his likeness and renaming places, while enterprising businessmen capitalized on Raffles' growing prestige by adopting his name and their brands, further boosting his international reputation. When Singapore became independent in 1965, the ruling political party deemed it utmost crucial to construct and frame a national narrative to unify the different communities. The story of Raffles founding Singapore in 1819 was chosen as the inception of its modern history. Raffles was depicted as the national hero who made the migration of Singaporean ancestors to the island possible, and thus laid the foundation of the Singaporean identity. the post-independence government saw a role model in Raffles too. His self-made career and fame were evidence that hard work and determination are the keys to success. This glorified narrative aligned with Singapore's meritocratic ideology, but it also perpetuated misrepresentations of the truth. Meanwhile, Fakwa was consigned to the dustbin of Singapore's national history, erased from our collective memory. With enough repetition, myths become facts. We often only remember the victors of history. The unfortunate caveat of studying and summarizing history is that key supporting figures like Fakwa typically lose their importance to more prestigious figures like Raffles. It is easier to attribute the work of many to one because, well, listing everyone involved in the chain of events would complicate narratives and make them hard to follow. Yet, without these nuances, questions to complex issues can only be given simplified answers, distorting reality. Even in this podcast, though I've discussed about Fakwa and Raffles in isolation, they were not the only players in their story. The people around them, the invisible ones, mattered too. It is the small actions of individuals that coalesce and drive the larger movements of societies. For Raffles and Fakwa in 1825, it was impossible to predict what would ultimately become of their legacies. Now that his battle with Fakwa was over, Raffles returned to his passion for natural history. He was admitted as a fellow of the Linnean Society of London, an organization devoted to natural history, and he co-founded the Zoological Society of London, serving as its first chairman and president. Raffles was also preparing to enter politics, but fate had other plans. On the 5th of July, 1826, 8 months after the end to Fakwa's petition, Raffles collapsed. A blood vessel had ruptured in his brain, and his body was found at the bottom of a staircase. It was one day shy of his 45th birthday. Raffles was predeceased by 4 of his 5 children, who had died within 3 years of one another between 1821 and 1823. His last remaining daughter survived childhood, but a similar fate befell her just before her wedding and 19th birthday in 1840. Saddled by her husband's outstanding debt and unable to cough up more money, Lady Raffles negotiated a debt settlement with the company. She lived the rest of her life stricken by grief until 1858. The Court of Directors' ruling had destroyed Fakwa's dream of returning to Singapore. But as the dark clouds began to lift, his future looked ever brighter. He was invited to a royal reception and was formally presented to the British King. Ship captains of the company also came together to honour Fakwa with an elaborate dinner along with toast and speeches. Following his passion for natural history and Asian cultures, Fakwa was elected as a member of the Royal Asiatic Society and later received an appointment in one of its committees that translated texts and manuscripts. Then, in 1826, like Raffles, Fakwa suffered a stroke. It was a minor one, and his condition eventually stabilized. However, his jaw had been affected. He never regained full control of his voice. Despite his health complications and despite pushing 55, Fakwa married a much younger woman, fathering 6 more children with her. The mistress he had kept during his time in Southeast Asia was left behind, but Fakwa later bequeathed to her his house and assets in Singapore. 5 of their surviving children became integral part of Singapore's pioneering community. It was from this line of descendants that Fakwa would have a great-great-great-great great-grandson, becoming the Prime Minister of Canada in 2015. His name is Justin Trudeau. Next episode, we will wind the clocks back to 1823. Crawford will continue from where Farquhar and Raffles had left off. Issues relating to finance, infrastructure, and government will weigh down on his administration. But before he can tackle them, he must first nudge the Temenggong and Sultan out of their nest. Meanwhile, the British and Dutch will return to the negotiating table and settle their differences over Singapore once and for all.